Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. This week on AK, gluttony. Thanksgiving is coming up, so chances are good we'll all be eating too much. But sometimes, even a small taste is too much.
Mom said I had to eat 2 spoonfuls, no exceptions.
And when bears come to eat at a remote hatchery, the people living there have to get creative.
But when they put on 6 inches of fat, you could be shooting cinder blocks at them and they wouldn't care.
All that and more coming up on AK.
AK is made possible by Tech Cominco, creating jobs for Alaskans at the Red Dog and Pogo mines, and by TeleAlaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice, data, and Wi-Fi technologies at TeleAlaska, on the web at telealaska.com.
Help manage subsistence hunting and fishing in Alaska. Apply for a seat on your local federal subsistence regional advisory council. The deadline for applications is January 9th. For more information, call 800-478-1456. This announcement is sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Subsistence Management.
Welcome to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Alaska's brown bears should be heading off to their dens for the winter, but before they do, they need to fatten up. During those months when they're at their gluttonous worst, they can become a real hassle, especially in places like Port Armstrong on the southern end of Baranoff Island. During the months of August and September, it's not uncommon for bears to outnumber the residents, almost 3-1. As AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports, when you live in a remote area and at a fish hatchery to boot, bears are going to be part of the experience.
At certain times of the year, Port Armstrong may have more brown bears per square inch than anywhere else.
When you can have 32 in sight at one time, that's getting up there.
John Thorrington is the maintenance manager at the hatchery. He says to be able to live with such a large number of bears, they sometimes have to take extraordinary measures.
And that compressed air cannon that we built is a shoulder-fired, recoilless, three-quarter-inch bore unit that'll throw a quarter-pound clay projectile about 450 yards. And at first, it seemed to be promising. When they're thin-skinned and no fat on them when they first show up in August, you can kind of get their attention with it. But when they put on 6 inches of fat, you could be shooting cinder blocks at them and they wouldn't care. So it doesn't do any good.
My first day in Port Armstrong, I saw 3 bears. 4, if you count the bear carcass that one of them was carrying off in its mouth. Port Armstrong hatchery manager Ben Contag says 3 bears is nothing. And I missed the peak of the season, which coincided with the low pink salmon returns.
Because our pink run was so short in time, by the middle of September, there was very few pinks left. And in a normal year, there'd still be pinks all the way through the 10th, 12th of October. And this year, by the middle of September, fish were pretty much gone. And they were pretty hungry, so, well, we had some cannibalism going on and bears killing each other.
Contag says when they start eating each other, the danger factor for humans is a little higher as well.
That's when I get more scared with people living here. You know, everybody needs to be a little more alert. Maybe a bear will decide a piece of a human leg is good to eat too. I don't know.
Even though a fish hatchery is kind of like a fresh salmon market for bears, Contag says he doesn't really know why so many hang out here. Most of the pens and the raceways that hold the salmon are either barricaded or surrounded with electric fencing. But Sindel Claycamp, who works as a fish culturist, says the bears managed to break in anyway.
Last year, though, we had these 2 bears. They were 2 cubs, and they were like about second years. And the mom ended up dying early on. She was the one that was found behind the bunkhouse. And they were so skinny that one of them could actually squeeze through the bars up at the head where the fish come through, so they had to be really skinny
those
in order to
really
do that.
Those really, really thin bars over there?
Those really thin bars. Squeezed into there and, like, was walking down the little aisles looking at all the fish.
Clay Camp says it would be justified to shoot a bear as defense of life and property, but that's really a last resort in Port Armstrong.
We always try to figure out whether we really have to or not, and seems how he got in just by squeezing between the bars, and he's definitely going to get fatter. We didn't have to shoot him or anything.
It just becomes a part of life. You don't open a door and walk out on the boardwalk without first checking for bears. Contact says it's a pain, but there's really no alternative.
My kids are, they're not allowed to come out of the house unless they're going out with me or somebody with a gun. It's kind of a bummer because they like to go play around outside, but I don't let them. Not at night, I definitely don't let them. And not even my wife. They're trapped in the house. So they're kind of like in jail because of the bears for part of the year.
10-year-old Ayla and 12-year-old LaVon Contag are the only kids in Port Armstrong. And when asked what they like to do, it all hinges on whether it's bear season or not.
Sometimes it can be hard that there's no other kids, but, you know, we just learn to play with each other and we go outside when there's no bears. When there's no bears, I like to go outside and walk with my dog, Coco. When there is bears, I like to stay inside and play games with LaVon usually.
And that compressed air cannon that John Thornton was talking about? That was a birthday present for 10-year-old Ayla. She can barely lift it, and she says so far she's only managed to shoot a potato at the wall. But if you live in Port Armstrong, it's never too early to learn how to coexist with a brown bear. For AK, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Bears aren't the only Alaskans with a thing for salmon. It's a staple menu item for plenty of people. So much so that the guys at Crab Bait Radio in Petersburg imagined a new way of distributing it.
Hey, look, it's the wild salmon truck!
Crab salmon guy!
Yeah!
Hey there, kids, what'll it be?
Hey, Mr. Wild Salmon! Can I have a pink pop?
I want a mint topic chocolate chumpsicle.
Can I please have a king salmon caramel cone?
Mr. Brister, I want a Haagen-Dazs puppy freeze with rainbow sprinkles.
And my little sister wants a soft serve silver salmon shortcake.
Okay, hold on there. Wait a second, one at a time. Here you go, little Billy.
Cool.
And Sally, here's your dog salmon Dixie cup. Oh, I almost forgot. A soft serve strawberry sockeye for little Todd with walnuts.
Thanks, thank you, wild salmon guy.
Well, thank you, kids. And don't forget, stay in school. Except when the wild salmon truck goes by.
Crab Bait Radio is produced in Petersburg by Matt Lichtenstein and Joe Vicnicki. Guest star on this story was Van Abbott. In truth, salmon isn't the most commonly eaten Alaska fish. Pollock is. It's found in fish sticks and items served by McDonald's and Long John Silver's and Taco Del Mar. The trade group Genuine Alaska Pollock Producers is marketing Alaska fish tacos for school lunches across the country. And now they're testing out four new dishes using Alaska students as their taste testers. Every Thursday, North Pole High School students are offered a fish choice along with the regular menu items. The recipes were developed by the Pollock producers. The group's Pat Shanahan says kids make good testers because they are, quote, discerning. Parents might translate that as just plain picky. The school district says the program helps meet their goal of serving more local food, and it helps the trade association determine if the recipes are worth eating. Around the country, gun salesmen have noticed a bit of gluttony, in a way, a binge of gun sales following the election of Barack Obama and Joe Biden. Gun sellers nationwide have reported significant sales increases. It's happening in Alaska's biggest city, Anchorage, and it's happening in Unalaska. KUCB's Ann Hillman reports.
And Alaska's only federally licensed gun dealer, Forrest Bowers, sits in his shop with a long black gun on his lap.
It's an AR-15 rifle that would be considered an assault weapon, and it has several features that make it fit into that category. It's a semi-automatic, magazine-fed rifle.
He points out parts on the exterior of the gun, like a collapsible buttstock that makes it more transportable, and a flash hider that makes it easier to shoot at night, but also conceals where the shot is coming from.
They're commonly used for hunting. They can be used for self-defense. This rifle is more or less the civilian equivalent of the M4 carbine that's used by our U.S. military.
Bowers explains it's one of the more popular guns, especially for shooting sports, but the 1994 assault weapons ban made it illegal until 2004 because of its extra features. At the moment, it's selling faster than ever. Gun sales have more than doubled on Alaska in the past month as fears grow over the potential new gun laws from the incoming Obama-Biden administration. Bowers won't say exactly how many guns he's sold, but half of them are long assault rifles, like the relatively inexpensive AK-47s commonly used for hunting. Peter Hamm with the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence says they shouldn't commonly be used for anything in the United States.
General Kalashnikov, the Russian engineer who designed the AK-47, has said repeatedly and publicly that never in his lifetime did he ever intend for the AK-47 to be a gun that was in civilian hands.
Hamm says the same is true for the other military-style assault weapons sold by Bowers and others nationwide.
We think that these are military weapons and that they serve no useful purpose in the civilian arena.
But Bowers says gun buyers in Unalaska feel differently. On an island with no big game, people are buying long guns and smaller handguns for self-protection and sport. And they're stocking up now in case they can't get them later. When the 1994 law went into effect, some guns doubled in price. Bowers says he fears the laws will expand to include more types of guns and add extra taxes to ammunition sales. But Hamm thinks buyers are overreacting to potential changes.
If there's a conversation in this country about reinstating an assault weapons ban, it's not going to happen quickly, and it's not going to happen behind closed doors. It's going to be a very transparent process. So if there comes a time when we get close as a country to banning them, you're going to have plenty of notice. You can buy your gun in the spring.
Bowers says because of high demands, he's already having trouble finding guns for his customers, let alone in the spring. He says people are just acting now to protect themselves and their rights.
I look at gun ownership really as a civil rights issue. You know, it's a basic human right.
In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman for AK.
Coming up after the break, finding the sweet side in a friend's final illness.
It's such a beautiful time of life. It's so sweet to be here with Blair.
Stay with us.
AK is made possible by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve. And by Alaska Business Monthly, giving a voice to Alaska business.
Welcome back to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. After many years living in South Central Alaska, chef, fly fisher, and traveler Blair Aubrey discovered the community of Gustavus in 2000. She lived there seasonally, cooking for friends, lodges, and bed and breakfasts. These days, Aubrey isn't able to do much cooking. In 2006, at the age of 48, she was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. She was in Arizona at the time, but her Alaska community stayed close. Some Gustavus residents helped financially, while others flew down to be with her. They were unable to stop the cancer, but they were able to convince Blair to come back to the community she fell in love with. Scott Burton has more.
Blair Aubrey is nestled in a couch in a cozy Gustavus cabin. Through a large window behind her, she is bathed by rich afternoon light.
I decided to come back to Gustavus and say, okay, this is going to be the place that I want to live for as much of the time as I possibly can.
There's an eagle's nest in a massive leafless cottonwood outside the window. The tree stands in an open yellow field where an owl can occasionally be seen hunting. Gustavus is beautiful, but that's not what has kept Aubrey coming back.
To be in a place where really so few people live, and they do such a tremendous job getting so much work done amongst and within the community. It's a place that I had never experienced in my life. I'd never seen anything quite like it.
The population swells to about 700 in the summer, but there are probably half that in town now, on the verge of winter. Hospice coordinator and friend Mary Cook joins Aubrey on the couch, and the two are sometimes joined by Aubrey's dog, Aria, an affectionate pet who is constantly kissing her owner.
My dog clearly likes it, too. That's enough.
Cook says small towns bring people close.
We're more intimate with each other on a daily basis than most families are. And I'm intimate with people that I'm not necessarily very good friends with. You know, it's just my community members. You know, the way we are together in this little place, you know, it's always very deep. And we care for each other. And we have fights and we get mad at each other. But when push comes to shove, we're really there for each other in a way that I don't know happens in too many other places, where we all drop what we're doing and we take care of whoever needs caring for at the time.
Even with their faults, Aubrey is known for being gullible and for a sassy side. If she's not happy, she'll let you know about it. Now, members of the community keep her company around the clock. Cook says demand to volunteer and to visit is great enough that it requires a schedule. Among the visitors is Janet Nielsen. She says one of the ways Aubrey gave to the community was through her cuisine. Aubrey actually joined Nielsen and her husband on their honeymoon kayak trip to nearby Lituya Bay. Although she wasn't invited because she was a good cook, Nielsen says it was a nice perk.
So this is from my journal from our trip to Lituya Bay, our honeymoon trip. Blair prepared our final feast. She is amazing. Smoked salmon pasta with our canned smoked Bartlett River coho, fresh chives, roasted beets and squash, and flaming cherries jubilee for dessert. We ate well.
Nielsen says that sharing food with people is bonding. Aubrey agrees. She's drawn to cooking and eating because of its communalism. In Gustavus, people have time to do things like eat together. And now, they have time to return the favor by caring for her. Mary Cook says that's almost as much for themselves as for Aubrey.
And it's something that will stay with you forever and make you feel really, really good about yourself to be able to help somebody when they are that vulnerable. And I think everybody will feel a little prouder of themselves, because I think a lot of times we think, well, I couldn't do that. You know, I couldn't be around somebody who was that sick or somebody who was dying. And then you do it and you realize it's such a beautiful time of life. As ironic as that may sound, it's so sweet to be here with Blair.
Aubrey says one of her biggest challenges every day is getting used to her new body. An outdoors woman, she can no longer fly fish like she once could. Highlights include strolling outside with Aria.
You know, cancer's a really horrible thing, but it doesn't have to ruin your life. And I'm learning that every day. I never thought even that I would get to live this long. And so that part is a little bit scary because it's so finite. But I'm gonna roll with what I get.
And she's gonna roll with it here in Gustavus until the end. It was a hard decision. There are more hospitals down south, and Aubrey has family in California.
You know, you tell people in California, or your oncologist in California, that you want to go to Alaska to spend 6 months, and they all look at you like you're kind of crazy. Like, what's in Alaska? What do they have up there that we don't have? What kind of treatment do they have that we don't have?
Treatment that's hard to quantify.
I have a community of friendships that I've had over so many years that is just like the fabric of my life. And your friends really support you in the most incredible of ways. And that's your community. Just the littlest thing that you could possibly do. And you get such a reward back from that, that you never want it to go away, ever.
In this community, they call it the Gustavus Love Bomb.
It's like true love, true filial, true, absolute, 100% love.
For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
Love is wanting to be loved. Love is touch. Touch is love.
On last week's show, we met a couple of Anchorage educators, Martha Gold Lee and Doreen Brown, who are dealing with an influx of rural Alaska Native students into city schools. This week, we continue with a closer look at why some Alaska Native families are moving into the state's urban areas. Meet Jennifer Kalmakoff, who moved her family from Shoreside Perryville on the Alaska Peninsula to a crowded trailer park in South Anchorage.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Ellen.
Hi.
Hi, Kim. Hi. Yeah. And you guys are?
Their purple trailer fronts a major highway, which is hidden from sight, but not sound, by a high wooden fence. The kids, all five of them, are home from school, most watching TV, but one girl, high school age Jenna, is working at the computer at a desk by the front door. Grandma and a puppy in a plastic kennel complete the family picture. It's a tight fit getting them all in.
Room to grandma.
I'm Ellen.
Jennifer Kalmakoff sits at the dining room table, edged up to a window with what would be a great view of the Chugach Mountains. That is, if the trailer next door was not in the way. A color photo of Perryville hangs by the window.
It's nice. Yeah. It's second to Hawaii.
The family came to Anchorage in March. I ask why and get an answer that takes my breath away.
It was very expensive. In a two-month period, it would cost us like $16,000 just to get by. And we couldn't do it anymore. We had to relocate our family and... And it's been more convenient up here for us, you know, saving-wise. And
Jennifer says older houses in Perryville were using up to 2 barrels of oil a month for heat.
Our oil was having to be flown in by a jetliner, and it skyrocketed the fuel costs to like $600 a barrel of fuel. Then the gas prices, we were paying like, what, $500 for a drum of gas.
Even the new three-bedroom HUD home Jennifer left behind gobbled up oil.
You know, some have the old version of stoves that would run probably a drum of fuel within 2 weeks. I know one family was going through a drum of fuel within 1 week, and that would cost them like $2,000 a month just to heat their home. But the more efficient homes, we were running probably a drum of fuel a month.
The family moved to Anchorage just as gas prices started going up here. They spent a couple of weeks in a hotel, then moved to a duplex before Jennifer found the trailer she bought. Jennifer and her husband both work in health care. They had jobs at the local clinic in Perryville. After the move, he traveled out of town for work, sometimes leaving for 2 weeks at a time.
We found it hard to be on the family, him being away. So he's with the hospital up here working now.
Jennifer is job hunting, but not worried about working. She is worried about her children's education. She says Anchorage is not bad on that score, but there's big problems with the transfer from one school district to another.
It was tough moving them from the village to up here because the Anchorage school district up here, they go by a grading system. And out in the rural villages where we're from, most of Bristol Bay uses a leveling system, and they're not familiar with the two. And so we got into like quarrelments with the Lake and Penn School District because my daughter came here and she only had, 4.25 credits. And she spent 4 years of high school out there in the village, and, you know, we're questioning where's the rest of her credits.
Both high school students in the family may have to make up credits in summer school. Jennifer says the family is making the transition to city life, but she misses Perryville. She points to the photograph by the window.
It's nice. It's, you know, you have everything there. You have all your seafood that you can ask for. In the back, we have a volcano that's, 22 miles back from the village. It is the largest volcano in Alaska, Mount Veniemeno.
This is my beach, my steam bath.
We have 15 miles of black sand beach. You can ride it. You know, it's the front is all ocean, but you have scattered islands. I know being away from home is hard for my kids, so we try to do things that we would do out in the village. You know, go walk the beach. We take them to Seward every once in a while, and they love to go swimming. Whether it be in the ocean or so we try to get them out to go swimming every once in a while.
She sighs. Perryville in summer is wonderful, she says, but the few jobs there dried up after the city completed a number of capital projects, and now things are pretty tough back home.
Right now there's no jobs available, and I know one of the stores is like basically ready to shut down, so I don't know.
But hard times or not, she says, the hope is always there, to go home.
I'd give it probably a couple years if I should decide to go back home. Time will tell, you know. If I decide to move on further, like, you know, just to higher educate myself within nursing, then I'll do that up here.
She says she may take the ferry back in spring to see family and friends. Until then, the Kalmykoffs are standing tall in Anchorage and determined to make it in the big city. Time now for our weekly trip around the state. This week, we head to Hughes on the Koyukuk River in the interior and Chicken near the Canadian border.
My name is Janet Byfield. I live in Hughes. And I work for the Hughes Tribal Council as a tribal administrator. We are located about 275 miles northwest of Fairbanks on the Koyukuk River. The languages that are spoken are mainly English, but the younger kids are learning the Athabascan, Koyukon Athabascan language right now in school, and they are doing very well. We have open gym. We have a computer lab that we have open for the community, and we get together and we try to do traditional learning types of things. Our life is kind of surrounding subsistence because in the summertime we go fishing, in the fall time we go hunting for moose. And during the winter, like I said, we have the community fish trap, and people set their own fish nets for fish. One of our challenges that we've been facing over the last about 6 years, I think, is we need to have a minimum of 10 students in our school in order to keep it open. And this fall, we just made 10.
Bronk Jorgensen, and I live in Toke and in the summertime in Chicken, Alaska. I run a tourism and a gold mining tours and historic town tour operation. The population in Chicken for the wintertime ranges from about 4 to 7 people, and in the summertime, the population is probably close to 30. The name was ptarmigan due to the large number of ptarmigan located in the area and on the creek. But when the post office was formed in the early 1900s, the miners couldn't agree on how to spell ptarmigan, so they settled on calling it Chicken. Yeah, originally it was a mining town that slowly turned into tourist destination in the summertime. Traditionally, miners and trappers in the year around. There's still quite a bit of active gold mining happening in the area, but there's not a lot going on right on Chicken Creek. The challenge would be keeping mining operations, small mom-and-pop mining operations, going into the future. Increased regulations and restrictions on what miners can do, and more so access into their mines is becoming an increasing problem for them.
We heard from Janet Byfelt in Hughes and Bronk Jorgensen in Chicken. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Time now for a look at AK's calendar of events. Talkeetna's Winterfest starts on December 5th with a parade and continues through December 6th with a chili cook-off, the annual Wilderness Woman Competition, and the ever-popular Talkeetna Bachelor's Ball. Wrangell's Festival of Lights is set for December 5th and 6th when stores stay open late to lure shoppers with special holiday sales. There'll be a craft fair bazaar on Friday at the Elks Club. As part of the weekend event, Santa will make an appearance, and don't miss the tree lighting ceremony. Sitka's annual Artisans Market is December 5th through the 7th at Harrigan Centennial Hall, in time for holiday shoppers to pick up some locally made craft items. After the break, a vegetarian reconciles with eating in Alaska and winds up with a movie.
My goal is to kind of trigger conversation about what we put on our plate. What is sustainability? You know, how do we relate to where we live? You know, what does it mean to stick the food that we buy in the store in our mouths?
That's ahead.
AK is brought to you by the Alaska Humanities Forum, using the humanities to enrich the civic, intellectual, and cultural life of all Alaskans. And by the new AT&T, your world delivered. The Alaska Community Foundation connects people who care with causes that matter across Alaska. Together, they can do so much more than can be done alone. For more information, call 907-334-6700 or visit their website at alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation.
You're listening to AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Much of what Alaskans eat comes from animals or fish that we harvest for ourselves. On Prince of Wales Island, there's an annual celebration for one of those animals, deer. The 6th annual deer celebration was held recently in Craig with workshops and presentations. Jay Marble stopped by.
During breaks between school groups, anthropologist Pat Petrovelli explained that she's working on a 2-year study of the Unit 2 deer uses and needs. That includes Prince of Wales Island and the surrounding islands, but not Ketchikan. She has a map of Prince of Wales broken up into little areas where people could be hunting and where they actually hunt the most.
Well, the main deer use occurs in the northern half of the island, you know, in just from the north of Craig and north in the Thorn Bay Waas in between where the roads are between Naugatuy and then Kaufman Cove.
And at the very tippy top, we have Point Baker.
And in that one wildlife analysis area, they have as much use as where the roaded areas are. And just that one separate one there, which might count where Wrangell and Petersburg residents come over.
In the first year of this study, Petrovelli asked people from the island, when it comes to deer, what are the most important things? Now, this is a long-term study, so all the answers will eventually need to be put into various categories. But she says, for now, the answers reflect the rural nature of Unit 2.
People said that was very important to them was as a replacement for store meat. And so, which seems logical, is in that rural areas, the store prices would be higher and they'd have less access to cash and just the cash isn't available to purchase store meat. And then generally in rural areas, people are self-sufficient. And so they go out and get food themselves to put on the table.
Recently, Petrovelli, who works for the Bureau of Indian Affairs and is doing the study on behalf of the Craig Community Association, says the questions are now being put to urban hunters who travel to Prince of Wales and the rest of Unit 2. Later, local hunters from Unit 2 will be surveyed. It all gets down to a requirement that rural residents have a priority for taking deer and other game. However, she says that priority has to have the minimum impact on urban hunters. As part of a similar but different study, she collected data from Ketchikan households. Remember, she's an anthropologist, so she's looking at how humans in different environments use deer.
It was interesting that 20% of the households in the Ketchikan area didn't use any wild resources whatsoever, whereas in a normal rural area, 95 to 100% of the households usually use wild resources, or in some rural areas, it's been as low as 90%, but 90 is the lowest I've ever seen in a rural community for using wild resources, and 80 was definitely a jump down, you know, to have just 80% of the households using renewable resources.
As far as using those renewable resources, June May had her own exhibit with a few examples to inspire.
We have everything, actually. We have deer jerky. We have burger that's been vacuum packed, burger that's put in freezer Ziploc bags. We also have the equipment that we're showing, the pressure cooker with assorted jars, the grinder, the vacuum packer.
May is a community wellness advocate with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. She was spreading the word about preserving deer to take advantage of its nutritional properties.
Well, as far as nutrition goes, they're very high in protein and in iron.
How do you think that compares to other red meats?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is they're a lot leaner, so you're not getting all the fat that you would get from beef or other meat spot in the store, and also no additives because they're grazing on natural plants.
But not all plants on Unit 2 are natural. Some are introduced. These plants do not have a friend in Marla Dillman, a wildlife biologist with the Craig Ranger District. Her presentation compared naturally occurring plants that are eaten by deer with the junk food plants that could be eaten by deer.
It's very important. Some of the invasives are poisonous, and some of them will just outcompete the good plants, and then you know, they some of the invasives they will eat, but the nutritional value's not as good, so they just have to eat a lot more, would have to eat a lot more of them versus the ones that actually grow here naturally.
Dillman says compared to other areas, Unit 2 is in pretty good shape regarding invasive plants, but she says people need to think carefully before they buy and plant seeds in their yards and gardens. I'm Jay Marble.
Deer hunting, or at least attempting to hunt deer, plays a role in a new documentary film called Eating Alaska. Filmmaker Ellen Frankenstein hopes the film will trigger a conversation about the food that we put on our plates and in our mouths. After a recent screening in her hometown of Sitka, she sat down with AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock to talk about the film. She says it's supposed to be a humorous and serious look based on her own experiences of moving from urban eating to the vastly different world of eating Alaskan.
When you're an outsider that's moved to Alaska and you live here a while, what's on your plate starts really changing, or you start getting really impacted, especially if you have the opportunity to work in Native communities and work cross-culturally. And it sort of changes the way you think about things. As I've always thought about these issues about what's on our plate and what we do with resources and how we relate to where we live, the slow food movement and the local food movements across the country have really taken off. So I sort of wanted to make a film that sort of played with the intersection of this local and slow food movement outside of Alaska and how we think about what's on our plate in Alaska.
You started making this film 3 years ago, is that correct?
This is very true, which is not untypical for documentary filmmakers. They can take 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10 years.
And I wasn't judging you by saying that.
No, but you do get funny because people, you sort of start walking around kind of hiding. People say, are you done with that film yet? Are you still working on that film?
I think about that time frame because you talk about the slow food movement and how it's really taken off, and then the slow film movement, no, how it's really taken off. 3 years ago, it probably wasn't such a big deal, but since then, Barbara Kingsolver came out with her book about eating within 100 miles of your home, and it seems like I've heard this a lot, and so when I first heard about your film, I thought, oh, I wonder if this is like actually past its prime.
Well, it's funny. Barbara Kingsolver and his book and Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma, actually came out after or while I was working on this film. I was really influenced by my own thoughts and a great book by Gary Nabhan called Coming Home to Eat. And there's been a lot of writing that, I mean, there's sort of, I mean, I think there's this kind of trendy stuff with what ends up on the bestseller list.
Well, I just wondered if your focus had changed at all over the 3 years of making the film. Were you always a central figure?
Oh, absolutely not. I never wanted to be in my own film. But what happened is I wanted to tell a story of maybe ambivalence and making choices and kind of like how everyday choices are kind of puzzling. And one of the things that inspired me to make this film, besides my interest in food and how we relate to where we live, was when I discovered some women I knew hunted. I mean, I used to go hunting with my husband, but I never thought about actually going hunting myself, given that I grew up in the suburbs and lived in cities and didn't ever even see guns. So the idea of hunting was, you know, not anything in my head. So when I found out some women I knew hunted, I thought, that would be an interesting part of the film.
Well, it is an interesting part of the film. It seems like it's generated a lot of discussion, at least here in Southeast. And the film is very, I think, has a real Southeast focus, although you do branch out and go to other parts of the state.
The film is a conversation trigger, you know, stimulator. It doesn't give answers. It doesn't catalog all the wonderful subsistence foods or plants and animals in Alaska. It's a funny and serious film about trying to figure out what to put on your plate and my sort of misadventures. I end up going caribou hunting in Kotzebue. I go to Wasilla to a vegan cooking class. I go to the state fair. I'm at Cake in a Culture Camp. A lot of the film is shot in Southeast because I didn't have the budget to travel all over, nor did I really expect the film to become a catalog. You know, I think that's one reaction. Some people say, like, why isn't there more in the bush? Why didn't you, you know, do everything about hunting and trapping? And it's really just, you know, it's a playful film. I mean, I bring up, you know, the dangers of farm salmon. I bring up the issue of toxins getting into wild foods. Bring up, you know, your choices about whether you're eating processed foods or, you know, wild meats, how far our food travels. I touch on climate change. I touch on a lot of things, and that's, yeah, I think I just wanted to touch and run. There's a thing where I talk about food miles and how, you know, in a fun way, I go shopping with my husband. He picks up things and they're from various locations. And when I was filming that scene, no one in the grocery store knew the issue of food miles. I called some of the corporations and asked, like, hey, where does the wheat in these pretzels come from? Where does the soybean from the tofu come from? And I really baffled the people when I called the corporations. And that's going to be in an extra. But, I was just trying to throw out a film that really just played with the questions of thinking about what's on your plate and living where we live. In Sitka, the screening was tied to kind of getting people thinking about a bunch of things, including launching a new greenhouse. So I'm hoping each place that I show it, there'll be like something. So people can decide what action or what issue or what they want to celebrate. Maybe they want to celebrate subsistence and wild foods. So that's what I guess when I made this film, I also was thinking about those fun kind of community screenings.
You said you never wanted to put yourself in your own film. How is that for you with this film, you being in it? And
it was an awful experience at first, and I'm part of a collective of filmmakers called New Day Films, and I showed clips of the film to other filmmakers, and they're like, you have to be in the film. And I was like, because I just had some beginning parts, and they're like, no, you're the, you know, every strong film, unless it's like kind of a didactic history film or some, you know, just voiced over to death, even though this film is pretty voiced over film, it has to have a narrative structure. It needs a thread, needs a sense of transformation. That's storytelling. So the film needed to have a story. And so I realized that, you know, when I started to work with some of the people I thought were going to be my characters, they weren't telling the story I wanted to tell, so I had to. And it was a lot of work. I had to have some coaching. It was really hard for me to do voiceovers. I really love other people's voices much more than myself, but, you know, that was the way I could tell the story. And I know that I can make people laugh. And, you know, I sort of think I'm playing a lot in this work. Here we are, two women talking about media. There's sort of this thing about the male voice of God and maybe the male way of making a film. So I think I was playing, you know, I'm a female, you know, when we think about some of the other films where there's the documentary filmmakers are in the film, people might think of Michael Moore and Morgan Spurlock. You don't think about, do any women filmmakers come to mind when you think of that genre of film?
No, not for me.
Right.
Yeah.
So I felt like I was being pushed to by other people to do this.
There is a really strong woman presence in this film,
which I think we need more of, you know?
Eating Alaska will show at the Alaska Health Summit on December 2nd and as part of the Anchorage International Film Festival on December 6th. Ellen Frankenstein has also created a YouTube channel called Eating Alaska, so people across the state can contribute to the discussion about food and where it comes from. For more on the film, head to eatingalaska.com.
Homegrown tomatoes, what'd life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy.
Anchorage poet KP has spent a lot of time waiting tables, so a lot of his poems are about food, or sort of.
Tonight's specials. For an appetizer, I offer you suspicion, insult, and worry soup. The salad this evening is mixed envy and jealousy. Your entree choices tonight are filet of solitude and sautéed bitterness, sadness ossobuco with fatigue demi-glaze, vengeance on a bed of infidelity, or hate-crusted, roasted rack of rage. For dessert, oh my friends, 1,000 apologies. I've given you yesterday's menu. I would never dream of serving such rotten food. No, for you tonight, dear ones, I have prepared. Better yet, just sit with me and eat.
KP, or Keith Lyles, has a new collection of poems just out from Plainview Press. It's called Spring Hunger, and it's available at plainviewpress.net. For our boss, Duncan Moon, there's one food from his childhood that will always leave an unpleasant taste in his mouth, and more important, in his memories of Thanksgiving's past.
As a child in the 1960s, holidays had a certain pecking order. Christmas topped the list, of course. Birthdays and Halloween were in the top five. Thanksgiving was right up there, too. I loved the family getting together, all the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles, the cousins people hadn't seen all year. I loved the turkey and pies, singing in church, the football games, and the long walk down to the beach to gaze out over the bay. But Thanksgiving had a big downside. A small thing, really, in the grand scheme of things, but to a young boy, it was huge. So big that Thanksgiving, in my mind, was two holidays. The dread-filled morning before I had to eat my creamed onions, and the relief-filled, joyous afternoon that came after the ordeal. Mom said I had to eat two spoonfuls. That was the rule. No exceptions. I remember shoveling the bites in and washing them down with large gulps of apple cider, then hoping I didn't gag in front of everyone like I did one year. I don't know what it is about creamed onions, but to this day they still make me cringe. The little pearl onions were bad enough, but that pool of icky cream sauce they came in had to be contained before it seeped into and tainted the other food on my plate. My tactic of choice was to sacrifice some of my sweet potatoes to build a dam between the creamed onions and the rest of the plate. I remember one year, I must have been about 10, my mom announced that we weren't going to have Thanksgiving at home that year, that my grandfather, a 2-star Army general, had arranged for us to have Thanksgiving dinner at the officers' mess on Governor's Island, an army base just off the Battery at the southern end of Manhattan. Going to Governor's Island was a rare treat for us, and going on Thanksgiving could only mean the best Thanksgiving ever. The food would be great, there'd be no dishes to wash, and surely there would be no creamed onions to spoil such an auspicious occasion. Anyway, after church, we went directly to the ferry dock, caught the first ferry across, and were ushered into the officers' mess, through the main door, past the polished brass cannons, past the flags of all the army divisions, to a large round table in the center of the room. It was all very grand, but when they brought out the main course, to my horror, there were not just two spoonfuls of creamed onions on each plate, but a whopping great pile. My heart sank. I looked at them, then looked round the table. I guess the look on my face told the story, because my grandfather winked at me and announced with the authority that only a real general can muster, "Today, no one has to eat their creamed onions if they don't want to." I looked at my mother, who smiled sweetly and nodded her head in agreement. My spirit soared. I knew right then that this was going to be the best Thanksgiving after all, and set about building a sturdy sweet potato dam to ensure it.
Duncan Moon is our editor and executive producer. And that's AK for this week. We had help from Ann Hillman in Unalaska, Jay Marble on Prince of Wales Island, KP in Anchorage, and the folks at Crab Bait Radio in Petersburg. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org, and check out the text rundown on the archives page. While you're there, sign up for our podcast. Check out past shows or send us an email to let us know how we're doing. Our email address is ak@aprn.org. AK's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reported from Port Armstrong and Sitka this week, and Scott Burton from Gustavus. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. Jessica Cochran is our senior producer, and our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Join us again next week.
AK is made possible by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, whose mission is to provide programs and services which inform, enlighten, and enrich the public. The new AT&T, your world delivered, and by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.